Everybody, and welcome the attendees as well. Just a little bit of that process. We've got two really big, juicy agenda items that I think will generate quite a bit of discussion among us, the commissioners and staff, which is really the purpose of our committees, is to allow a group of commissioners and staff to delve more deeply into certain topics than we do at our regular commission meetings. So very often we don't have any input from attendees because there just isn't time. If there is at the end, we'll take a look at that. But generally this will be a discussion between the commissioners and staff. So welcome everybody. And let's go ahead and start with our, well, Eric, do you want to say anything? And then we can dive into our first agenda item, which is the at-risk ungulate and predator management topic.
Just very briefly, because we do have two meaty topics, as you pointed out. We have quite a few folks. I don't know if, Kim, I wasn't sure if you could maybe see the whole list based on who you were describing. I just wanted to make sure you also knew that Anise is here and Amy Windrope, and then also most of the lands team and Dave Whipple from Hunter Ed for the second agenda item. But you are correct that we're ready to go for agenda item one with Brock and Anise. And I'd say we get into it because I think there's going to be a lot of conversation.
Thanks for that, Eric. Okay, so Brock, I think you're up.
Okay, let me see if I can get my screen shared here. So first, it's good to see everybody. I hope everybody's doing well. I know me personally, I'm kind of over the staying at home stuff, but it is what it is. Let's see. All right, can you see it?
Yes.
My screen? Okay. Let me change my video.
Also point out,
okay,
we have about 37 participants and our full panel. So,
okay, so we'll get started. So I'm just going to give, I think everyone was provided a copy of the presentation that I'm going to give today. So it's just an update on efforts that we've initiated in association with addressing some of our concerns we have about at-risk deer and elk populations in Washington. A little bit of what we'll covered today. So this, it's limited to deer and elk. We'll kind of go over what the criteria that's used to define an at-risk ungulate population. And then I just want to briefly review what the guidelines are that are established in the game management plan. And then we'll do kind of a status review recap of kind of what was presented at the commission meetings in March. But then also go into a little bit more detail for a couple of those populations. And then I have questions at the end, but obviously I think this is gonna be a very fluid conversation and, you know, ask questions as we go through this as you deem appropriate. So just real quick, how we define an at-risk ungulate population. Right off the bat, it's got that component about whether it's a state or federally listed ungulate population. Those by default are automatically considered at risk. That would include, we've kind of lost the Selkirk Mountain caribou, but the Columbian whitetail deer down in Southwest Washington would still be in that category. And then it would include a population that falls 25% below its population objective for two consecutive years, or if harvest decreases by 25% below the 10-year average harvest for two consecutive years. Couple caveats to that is we don't have numerical objectives for every population because we can't estimate abundance everywhere. And then there's a little bit of ambiguity around what do we mean by harvest. So we'll touch on that a little bit more. So here's an example, and this will also help us orient ourselves to some of the other figures I have. So this is for black-tailed deer at the statewide level. And so we've got the thicker dark gray bar at the top, that's the most recent 10-year average. And then this dotted, lighter shaded gray line below it, that's representing what would be 25% below the 10-year average. So a little bit on the guidelines. It's kind of got, they've got really four components to it. They've got the guiding principles, the action consideration. That kind of delves into, you know, what would we consider, you know, targeting individual predators, or would we try to do something at a population level? What are some of the strategies we would use? It identifies in there that if we go down that path, we definitely want hunters to be one of the tools that we go to first. And then some of the assumptions that come out of the scientific literature, you know, when you do something like this, you got to acknowledge your assumptions you're making when you do it. So it goes through that. And then it lays out the strategies, and there's really four steps to this. And it's, the first one is to define the problem and rationale for the proposed action. And you've got to look at both the prey and the predator populations. You've got to look at, you know, other factors that are probably at play or could be at play, which would include disease or weather events, things like that. Obviously, harvest is a big one. And then you have to go through and do a risk assessment. And if you were to consider this or implement this management approach, what are the risks that come with it? And those are both biological and to some extent political. It identifies in there, what are the risks that would be associated with stakeholders that are either in support or opposition to this? And then you develop the proposed action, and then you obviously have to have extensive public review, as with everything that we do. So we'll start with white-tailed deer. We have six management zones for white-tailed deer. We have no numeric objectives.
Yep. Brock, let's halt here, because I think there are probably already some things that we want to talk about and ask questions about. So I guess I will start. I'd like to go back to the guideline, the ungulate population or harvest guidelines that are used for defining at risk. As you pointed out, there's a problem with harvest. It's pointed out in our white-tailed deer, where we've gone to pretty much antlerless in some of our management zones. And so it looks like our harvest is decreasing because we consider both antlered and antlerless, those kinds of things. The 25% per se, where does that come from? Do we look at trends at all? Let's talk a little bit about the guidelines first. And I don't know if any of the other commissioners want to chime in with other thoughts on that issue. Okay.
Do you want me to answer?
Go ahead.
So the 25% was initially defined in the wolf management and recovery plan. I think a big component of where that number probably came from is there's a lot of annual variation in these populations. Also, there's limitations related to our harvest estimates that revolve around precision. And so I suspect those things were, you know, are primarily the things that were probably considered about, you know, if we had chosen 10%, for example, that's not, that kind of annual variation in an ungulate population is not really unexpected. And so that probably was part of what was considered when they identified that. But I think those are probably the two primary reasons where that 25% comes from.
This is Jim Anderson. I've got a question. There's obviously quite a range between, say, 10% and 25%. And not having been part of the discussion, you know, when the wolf plan was developed, I don't have that background, but the it seems like that's the standard answer, that it was developed during wolf and then subsequently rolled over in the game management plan. And it seems to me that it's a little vague, and therefore I'm interested in having a deeper review, or at least a better understanding of this 25% versus some other number. I don't know what is used in different states or regions to compare. That would be helpful. And then the 10-year rolling average seems to me to be somewhat problematic in the sense that if you take a look at populations, known estimates of take over time, you know, some areas have gone down very, very significantly, and yet they're not even in that in the threshold. You know, a bunch of questions there, and maybe you can expand a little bit on that.
Yeah, so I think, so Anise and I have discussed this in the past as well. He's more familiar, has a little bit more experience with what other states are doing. He's kind of expressed that other states have kind of used that number. As far as the, you know, the 10-year average, I agree. It's got this rolling kind of average component to it that I do think we need to revisit and assess that, because if you do have a population that's declining at a slow enough rate, it may, and you allow that average to keep rolling, I think we have to acknowledge that in those situations, that those populations may never meet the definition. Now, that being said, if we see that kind of trend happening, right, I think that's still something we need to address. And I think we can articulate that to our constituents that, yes, by definition, you know, we haven't met this criteria, but we see this gradual, slowly, continuous decline. I think we have the latitude to initiate that discussion, even if we're seeing that. Anise, would you add anything to that?
Yeah, I guess once we go through some of the data, you will see that there really aren't any that fit that description where they've been through time declining and the 10-year average doesn't. All of the populations that we'll be talking about have had ups and downs. And so I think a 10-year average does apply and is valid in almost all the situations. Yeah, there will be maybe in the future, small declines over time that we may not capture, but I don't, as we look at the data, we can tell whether that's happening or not. So it's not like, you know, there's a guideline and we like to use it, but if we have other reasons to think that there's an issue, we can also look at it as well. And that's not the case in almost every instance that we have currently. And as far as getting to the 25% number, there's nothing magical about the 25% number. It's just, if you do it any lower, I think you would catch the variation that would happen from year to year, and you would be chasing a number that's not realistic. So, I mean, we could change it and make it whatever we would like it to be, but then we would be more reactionary, probably for most cases for no reason, because there's variation both in the way we estimate harvest and in the harvest itself from year to year. So we wanted to put a large enough number that would capture real changes, not just annual variation. And it is fairly it is used by other states, the similar number. It's between 20 and 25%. But and the reasons for that is the precision of which we can measure some of these things that we're measuring.
It would seem that a lot of the background or the normal way of doing business and the quality of the data that you have would be distinguishing factors between how different states set that level. So for instance, if we are pretty accurate with certain type of estimate that maybe our number could be different or would be different than another state. So I guess I'm just suggesting that that's worth looking at over time, or, you know, through the game management plan update or whatever, so that we're not just looking at something that was developed 15 years ago and remains the same. So that's,
I totally agree with you. And that is something we plan to look at when we do the game management plan. And then looking, and obviously the way we would look at it is we look at our data sets and our precision and then figure out where that cutoff point would be. And so I think that was done back when they did it. I can't be 100% sure. And usually when we do those types of things, we look at retroactively at the data and see where maybe populations were low and we didn't detect them, or where they weren't low. And so we would kind of do that kind of analysis. And that is something we intend to do.
The one question I have is, as far as the calculation goes, is how it is, how precise or how refined is that? Is it a lumping of information via game management units or subherds, or is it a percentage of a percentage, or is it trying to do is it looking at actual numbers all the time? So it just seems to me that there's room for a lot of fuzz if it's 25% reduction or a number in a particular area with a higher population versus a different percentage with a different number in a different area. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a good question.
Makes sense.
So what we're using now is either at the deer zone level or an elk herd level. Those are pooled GMUs. And so as we go down so if we're using harvest data to do this, and in most cases we are. So with our harvest estimates, as we go down in geographic scale, our precision gets less and less and less. And that's all a function of sample size, right? So when you go at the statewide level, we're sampling way more hunters than we are. The thing that needs to be pointed out is for the non-respondent hunters, that's estimated, I think, at a statewide level, and then it gets applied to each of those scales because they can't estimate that at like a GMU scale. Sample size just gets too low. And in those non-respondents, there's some GMUs where, that's a random survey that's done by WSU. There's some GMUs where we have such low harvest that they never even come into contact with a hunter that even hunted there. So that gets applied. And so the zone and the elk herd kind of level is kind of the medium of the, it's medium ground in terms of precision. We had some examples of that at the March meeting where, like, for example, the mule deer in the Northeast zone, that harvest was jumping all over the place. And I remember getting questions about that. And I think a lot of that was mostly just being driven by the precision and the sample sizes, because there's so few mule deer harvested there. So does that kind of answer your question? I also, I guess, would add on to that one thing I want to look at for how we define at risk, I think you make good points about one size kind of doesn't fit all. And so I do think that we need to look at, when we did our ungulate assessment in 2015, one of the challenges we were trying to define, well, what harvest? Because in some places we do have, like on the west side, where we have quite a bit of tribal harvest, like for Olympic elks. But then if you go to the east side and go to the Blue Mountains elk, it's almost all by permit. And so we struggled with, do we just use general season harvest, or do we include tribal? Do we not include tribal? We don't have tribal estimates on the east side. Some places it's all general. Other places we have permit. So I'd like to revisit that when we update the game management plan and say, okay, do we define a blanket definition, or can we adjust this a little bit to be more reflective of the information that we have in each location for each one of our populations.
I think that's good. I guess we probably do want to get into the presentation, but it's, for instance, in the management zones. So you look at the management zones, and then you kind of 5 out of 6 are good or not below the threshold. So there is a lumping of GMUs into those management zones, obviously. And then there are, there's certainly, I guess maybe deer might not be as accurate as elk, but there are definitely subherds of populations within GMUs that, to my thought, it would be that there could be disproportionate impact upon some of those subherds or whatever that's getting washed, if you will, by the lumping that occurs. And so I don't have a well-formulated, well-articulated question, but my concern is that we need to make sure that we may not be as precise there because we are kind of lumping and then we are taking percentages. And so you end up with not getting as fine of a resolution of the problem that may exist. So I don't want to presuppose where the problems are. I don't have that background, but that would be my concern here.
And I think that's very fair. I think, you know, when we did the ungulate assessment, we had a lot of folks that reviewed that and said the same thing and expressed the same concerns. So some of the limitations we have to that, so we've kind of talked about, if we take our harvest data down to that level, we probably have to have something that's higher than 25% because of the precision we're going to lose at that level. And we do see a lot of more of that variation at a GMU level. If we look at the populations where we use abundance estimates, which I think is better than using harvest, and that's elk and mule deer, we do those surveys when animals have migrated to winter concentration areas. And so one limitation we have, like for example, in the blues is, okay, we come up with an estimate of 4,600 elk. We can't with any great deal of reliability or precision take that back out and say 500 of those elk, you know, during the hunting season are in this GMU and 200 are in this GMU. That's the limitation we would run into. So that's going to be one of the considerations about why don't you go down to a finer scale? Well, with abundance right now, we can't do that for a lot of our populations.
Thanks, Brock. Molly.
Yeah, thanks, Kim. My question is, has the 25% ever triggered a management action in this state?
Not since it's been in place. So when we did our assessment in 2015, nothing was even close, you know. And then these last few years, we've had some events that have happened that these populations have declined.
We may talk about this later, but Molly's question raises an issue that I've been thinking about in regards to this. Looking at the Bow Hunters last publication, it's kind of a social issue, but you know, we've set this bar, and I think often our human hunters feel like they're the first ones to be cut out when we're seeing some sort of trend or something, we take an action. And it's always harvest rather than, I mean, I think that's often why we're asked all the time, what are we doing about other predators? You know, we're sort of the predator competitor who gets cut out. And I just kind of raise that as something to think about as we move forward with the new game management plan and all. I guess we're ready to proceed.
Okay.
I don't see any other hands.
Okay. Move my video back over on my other screen. I felt odd kind of looking up at it, trying to interact with you folks. So, okay. Okay, so we'll start with white-tailed deer. We've got six management zones that we've formally identified for white-tailed deer. We don't have numeric objectives for those. These populations were most strongly affected by the 2015 drought. There was an effect in 2016, 2017 after that winter, but not to the extent that we saw with some of our mule deer and elk populations. General season harvest was used to assess at-risk status. That includes both antlered and antlerless harvests during general seasons. We chose to go that route to be consistent with what we did with the ungulate assessment in 2015, but definitely want to revisit that. No zones currently meet the criteria of an at-risk ungulate population. Harvest assessments in 2019 dropped more than 25% below the 10-year average in three zones. So we did have three zones where we've got year one of meeting the criteria. So at a statewide level, again, I've highlighted 2015 there. Following that drought, we saw a substantial decrease in our harvest. There was a lot of reports. We also had a blue tongue outbreak that year. We didn't go out and formally estimate those mortalities, but it was a real thing. Then there's that bad winter. So the example on here for why we would like to revisit, the use of both antlered and antlerless. So as you guys know, we pulled back on all recreational antlerless opportunity in the Northeast. That was to the tune the previous year. They had harvested about 950, somewhere in that ballpark, antlerless deer. And so if those seasons had still been in place, we would expect this kind of statewide harvest to be a little bit higher, because that's where most of our deer harvest, whitetail deer harvest occurs in the state. So if we look at those three zones, we've got the Selkirk, that's up in, like I said, the Northeast. We've got the Okanagan Highlands. It's just right next door to GMUs, which is 101 and 204. And then we've got the Palouse, which is kind of that east central down to the south. Down towards Pullman, and then it crosses over the Snake River and extends kind of into the Blue Mountains range. So for that Selkirk and Okanagan Highlands, we're going to continue to watch that. As I mentioned, we eliminated the recreational doe harvest. I will mention in District 1 that in 2019, we actually saw our buck harvest tick up a little bit. And so we're optimistic that that trend will continue as long as favorable environmental conditions persist. We're optimistic that we're going to continue to see that go up in the absence of antlerless harvest. So kind of the same with the Okanagan Highlands. That was GMU 101, as I meant, most GMU 101 and 204. Most of the whitetail in the Okanagan Highlands occur in GMU 101. And again, that was a GMU where we had pulled back all antlerless harvest beginning in 2019. If we were to meet the at-risk, you know, criteria next year, if we saw that dip in harvest up there, you guys are well aware of the predator-prey study that we have going on up there. We would obviously use the findings from that work to inform, you know, our consideration of whether we implement predator-prey management guidelines up there or not. So for the Palouse, it's bisected by the Snake River. So you've kind of got this north and south. I'm sure some deer swim the river, but they're not doing it on a regular basis. And they're actually kind of they're kind of the same ecotone, but management for those two populations are quite different. So it's something we've initiated efforts to update the whitetail deer plan. And that's something the development team has really looked at and said, probably makes sense to break those two apart. in the south half, we're not 25% below a 10-year average if you were to just take harvest in that south half. And then in the north half, we're really dealing with private agricultural lands, right? That's prime wheat field country. And so management direction there is really driven by trying to mitigate private landowner concerns around damage. There wasn't a big effort to reduce antlerless opportunity there following the declines, because just prior to that, damage issues, there was quite a few damage issues, and landowners there haven't really expressed a really strong desire to bring those white-tailed deer populations back up. But it's definitely something I think we're going to talk about as we develop our three-year season setting process.
Rock, this is Jim Anderson.
Go ahead.
Can you go back to the Okanagan Highlands, and when you mentioned the if the numbers dropped in the second year, that you'd look to the predator prey guidelines, can you talk a little bit more about that?
So the predator prey guidelines or the predator prey study?
Predator prey study, I'm sorry.
Yeah, so that's occurring in GMUs 117 and 121. So that's the study where they've radio collared whitetail deer and elk and cougar, and they've got wolves and they've got bobcats, all those components. And they're trying to not only kind of get what are the baseline demographics of those populations, you know, survival, productivity, things like that, but they're also looking at what are the drivers on those demographics? So, you know, what effect is predation having? Because 101 is right next door, you know, I think that we would probably rely on those findings to inform any approach that we would take in 101. At least that's what my position on that would be.
The those results are in what stage of the process? What the data has been collected, is being analyzed now, or how ripe is that to be used, should that be the case?
So this is their final year of collecting field data. I think it's still probably, you know, at least 2 years out before you see the final publications, you know, from the research. But that there's going to be information in there that we can start using, I think, in advance of, you know, the formal publications. So that was something we really stressed with in our partnership with, you know, University of Washington and their researchers was, you know, there's a lot of research value here, but we have a lot of management value associated with this work. And we're interested in those nuts and bolts. Those nuts and bolts are going to be ready before the Cadillac, you know, gets sent out. And I think we will have that information available to us to inform that discussion.
Okay, that's helpful, because, you know, waiting for the final report, and it may be written up in a way that's just, you know, has a different purpose in mind, or perspective in mind, that it'd be important not to sit back and wait. And I'm glad that you're dialing in.
Yeah. I mean, I can already tell you that I had, so our lead ungulate research scientist on that project, she sent me just a breakdown. And one of the interesting things that I can tell you from the white-tailed deer up there, you know, when you look at the causes of mortality, it's about split. You know, the two main causes of mortality are predation and roadkill, you know, and so I think that right there is informative. You know, predation is not the only thing happening up there.
Right.
The fact that we're losing almost as many deer to roadkill up there says something.
Yeah, although predation can be a factor on different age classes and affect the numbers in different ways.
Yep, absolutely.
I have a question that's unrelated to this, and it has to do with the management zones, and it kind of comes up with the thought about dividing the southeastern River Palouse zone, which is quite large. What do these zones have to do with herds and their migration patterns and everything?
So that is accounted for in mule deer, but for whitetail, we don't see a migration kind of component there. And so when the original whitetail deer plan was developed, it was developed really just with a habitat. It was broken down by like ecological tone, you know, ecotones. So that's why the whole Palouse, you know, that whole kind of area got included, even though you have this geographic feature, the Snake River, that really divided those two into separate populations. Another consideration, for example, is GMU 124, right? That kind of encompasses Spokane North up into District 1. That's really a GMU where it's a bunch of ranchettes and agriculture. And the way we manage whitetail there is very different than what we do in District 1. And so that's another consideration. That those are all bundled into the Selkirk zone. That's another example where we're looking at that and we're saying, yeah, the habitat and the ecotone is the same, but there are other considerations that we should be taking, you know, we should be looking at to define these zones. So for mule deer, it's kind of a mix of what we think are connected populations that share migration. So like that East Slope Cascade zone, that's a really big zone that goes from basically Wenatchee, you know, all the way up to the Canadian border. And it's because there's really no clear spot in there that all those deer are behaving in kind of the same way where they go and they migrate to the, you know, the Pasayton, the U.S. Forest Service, spend their summers there. And then they migrate down to the Front Range. But there's really no clear kind of where would you divide the line and say this is not one interconnected population. You know, that's hard to define. And so that's kind of why that one's so large.
Thanks. I don't see any other questions, so why don't we proceed, Brock?
Okay. I guess I got a question with regard to why are you going to be in the mule deer or –
Yeah, we touch on mule deer.
I mean, okay, because I have a question with regard to East Slope, but I'll get to that later.
All right. I locked you guys on my other screen. Now I can't see my presentation. Come on. Okay, I'm just going to minimize you because now I can't get you off my... I can't get you off my screen. What'd I do? There we go. Okay, now we're good. All right, here we go. We covered that. We talked about Palouse. So yeah, we'll go into mule deer now. So we formally identify 7 management zones for mule deer. Again, we don't have any numeric objectives that are identified in the mule deer management plan, but we do periodically estimate abundance. In most places, we're trying to get that abundance estimate every 3 years. We just can't do it on a yearly basis because these mule deer populations spread across such large areas. It's just cost prohibitive for us right now, given our current budgets. But we try to do surveys every year to get ratio data from those populations. These populations were strongly affected by both the 2015 drought and the 2016-2017 winter. Again, we use general season harvest to assess at-risk status. 5 zones currently do not meet the criteria of an at-risk ungulate populations, and 2 zones met the criteria beginning in 2017 and 2018. They have increased slightly, though, in recent years. We look at mule deer statewide. When we saw those effects of 2015 and 2016 on a broader scale, we did pull back on our antlerless harvest, and we have seen a response at a kind of a statewide level. But that hasn't been the case in every zone, at least to the extent, if you look at like the slope or at what rate are they kind of rebounding, that hasn't been consistent in every zone. So the two that we haven't really seen rebounding as much as we like are in the Chiefs, which is kind of Yakima north up to I-90, and then the East Columbia Gorge, kind of down there by White Salmon, that area.
It'd be Yakima south of I-90.
Yeah, so from Yakima north to I-90, that to the Cascade Crest, that basically is what where the Natchez Mule Deer Zone is.
Right.
So in the East Columbia Gorge, some other things that we think are at play here is in the early 2000s along those East Slope Cascades, or down, not in that zone, but in the Natchez and East Columbia Gorge zones. That's where we first documented kind of the hair loss syndrome that had plagued black-tailed deer for several years before that. I do believe it was a different species of exotic louse. I'd have to go and look. But when that first happened, we did note it affected those populations negatively. I don't have like a formal number for you to what extent we think that had effect that had on those populations, but it definitely was there. Additionally, in the East Columbia Gorge in 2017, we documented an adenovirus outbreak that resulted in a die-off. We began to reduce recreational doe harvest in 2019. So the other thing we have to recognize here is that, so because of the timing of our surveys, there's always this kind of delay in our response if we do it based on numbers. Because that winter happened, we do our surveys in December. So December 2016, we did a survey. Our numbers seemed okay. The winter happened, and we didn't do our next survey till the winter of 2017. And so there was a little bit of delay there. We may consider further reductions during the next 3-year season setting process. We do have currently opportunities for archery hunters still to harvest antlerless deer, and we have some youth permits. In 2019, though, that was only to the tune of about 35 to 40 harvested does. But we will be talking with district staff there to decide whether we just pull back on all of it. As we move into the Natchez, again, we have the hair loss syndrome first showed up in the early 2000s. I will say that there was also a suspected adenovirus outbreak there, but it was never confirmed. So I didn't stick it in there as something we know for sure, for certain, that it happened. Recreational opportunities to harvest antlerless deer have not been allowed since 2006. Another piece of this population is that I probably need to build another figure that takes harvests further back in time, because this decline started occurring much sooner than what the figure I have in this presentation. It started occurring in the late 1990s. And so when you look at our harvests where we're at now, I mean, it's to the tune of when this population was at its peak, you know, it's probably more than 70% below, 80% below what it was historically. So I do think the decline in this mule deer population is larger than what's indicated by the figure that I have in this presentation.
Brock, yep. I need to be attentive to time. We're all interested in this and lots of questions, but we do have another presentation, so let's keep it rolling. Let me break. Are there any questions at this point from commission members?
Okay, this is Jim Anderson. I have a question with regard to mule deer on the East Slope Cascades. That's a very big area, as you noted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it ranges from, you know, up to Paysatin all the way down to Wenatchee. And so is there masking of trends associated with the size of that? That needs to be sorted out. In particular, I've heard concerns with regard to the Okanagan mule deer population, wondering if you know, the rest of the area is compensating, if you will, for that, and why that's not in the in an area where we're concerned.
So we haven't done that. So we haven't broke it out into, we kind of informally identify three subherds in that East Slope Cascades, which is south, central, which is most south is Kittitas, central is kind of Chelan, and then the Okanagan up in the north. And so that's how our abundance estimates are kind of facilitated and broken out when we do surveys. Specific to the, we haven't seen those, we've seen declines in the Chelan and that from our surveys, but nothing that reaches the level of being at risk. And we also have issues there with weather preventing us from getting recent surveys. Specific to the Okanagan, the other thing that we have to take in consideration there are the wildfires that happened. I mean, we had two or three years where almost 1 million acres were burned, and they severely affected the winter range of those mule deer. When that first happened, we actually responded by increasing antlerless harvest to hopefully have minimized the effect of that deer population on a severely damaged winter range. Since then, harvest has, we've backed off on that. Antlerless harvest is relatively low. There were consecutive years where we did see effects of that habitat on fawn recruitment or fawn production or fawn surveys in December. They went down after that, indicating that, yep, there was probably a habitat component there. In recent years, we've seen those numbers come back up, those fawn numbers. So we do think the habitat's recovering a little bit, but we have to be cognizant of that and recognize that that winter range habitat isn't quite what it was, and we've got to give it time to rebound. Otherwise, we could overwhelm it and do the exact thing if we just allow those deer populations to come completely back to the level that they were prior to those fires.
Okay,
let's keep going.
Okay. All right, so I'll fly through this. So the other thing we have in the Natchez is the Muckleshoot Indian Tribe has been monitoring adult female mule deer in this zone since 2013. So annual survival rates from that work have varied annually. They've averaged 81% across study years. They were the lowest in 2015 when we had drought. They dipped down to about 67% that year. When you have 67% annual survival on adult female mule deer, that population is going to decline. And then our next lowest was in 2016. Given that mostly this is an unhunted mule deer population, we would expect our adult female survival to be above 85%. So breaking down into kind of what their preliminary findings are is cougars been the primary cause of mortality. But we have a number of mortalities that are associated with malnutrition in deer. So that indicates that this population is experiencing some nutritional limitations. Human-caused mortalities have accounted for 10%. Those have included illegal harvests, and then there's still limited tribal harvest that's allowed there. All other causes have varied in the range of 1% to 7%. We look at it on an annual basis. The annual specific, cause-specific mortality rate, again, cougars have been the leading cause in most years, but if you look at 2015, malnutrition was actually the leading cause-specific mortality rate for adult female mule deer. 2016, those predation and malnutrition were about equal, and not until 2019 did we kind of see the malnutrition not be in there for the first year. The bolded.
Brock, yep. this is Molly. I have to ask a very embarrassing question.
Okay.
I'm not quite, I don't think I'm understanding how these graphs are laid out. Can you just briefly explain, like, what's the number in the center?
So the number in the center that I put in there, that is the recreational cougar harvest that occurred by state hunters.
Okay, so in 2013, for example, it's 6.
Yep, it's 6.
Okay, and the other percentages are the other mortalities?
Yeah, so, no, that's fine. So 8% of, so this is the annual mortality rate for the deer.
Okay.
Right, so 8% of deer in the population, proximate cause of mortality was cougar predation.
Okay, okay.
When we come down to 2016, 7% of the deer cause-specific mortality rate for deer was malnutrition. So 7% of the deer population, proximate cause of mortality was nutrition.
Got it. Thank you. I'm so sorry. I was just falling behind there for a second.
That's fine. And I apologize that these were a little confusing. So the cougar harvest, all we were kind of indicating there was because there's a lot of discussion about, right, implementing cougar management actions to get a response out of these populations. And so if we look at our cougar harvest in 2017, we went over our quota. In 2018, we went over the quota. In that year, tribal hunters also harvested more cougars that year compared to what they did in previous years. And all this is showing is that there indicates a trend that maybe the cause-specific mortality rate of adult female mule deer in this population has gone down a little bit as cougar, you know, harvest went up. But it's not a large, you know, it's not a large decrease in that cause-specific mortality rate. So it's just important to emphasize that these are preliminary data. They've not undergone any kind of rigorous analysis. Preliminary findings indicate cougar predation and nutritional limitations are the two primary factors influencing the survival of adult female mule deer. Information that is lacking for this population is anything related to the fawn component. We struggle to do traditional surveys in this zone because there's an overlap between blacktail and mule deer, and it's very difficult for biologists to distinguish a blacktail young adult doe versus a mule deer fawn at that time of the year. And so they don't estimate fawn to doe ratios, and we haven't measured fawn recruitment directly. And that's important because this population is indicating that there's nutritional limitations. And if there's nutritional limitations, that's going to be borne out on fawn survival even before adult survival. So if we're seeing that effect in adults, it's probably an indicator that our fawn numbers may not be doing very well either.
Brock, the malnutrition issue, is that related to impacts from fires or lack of logging or any idea?
It's hard to say. So that's gotta be part of our discussions with more staff, because there have been wildfires in that zone that probably should have benefited some mule deer habitat.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of forest enhancement work that's taken place there. And so you would think that there would be some benefit, but the fact that we're still seeing these nutritional limitations, something's probably going on. I think we need to have a broader discussion about that and put our heads together and talk through that and quantify what we think those benefits from fires or forest management strategies should have resulted in. But it's still there, right? And the fact that we see it in most years, not just in the years where we have drought or harsh winters, even in what we would, I guess, maybe assume to be normal years, we're still seeing it there. 2019 was the exception. And I felt like last year was prime conditions for ungulates. That's why I was surprised we didn't see the result in our elk populations.
Thank you.
So yeah, so we're going to start initiating discussions with, you know, in collaboration with the Muckleshoot Indian Tribe to start talking through some of this stuff, because we really hadn't done that internally yet. So for elk herds, we've got our 10 elk herds. We have 4 below objective, the Clackam, Yakima, reminder, we pulled back on antlerless there. We're hoping we get a response, not planning to do anything there until we see if we get that response. Mount St. Helens, we finished our elk hoof disease study, not likely to consider anything there, even though that population continues to struggle. Hoof disease is playing a big role, and we just wrapped up our, you know, 5-year study, and from that we didn't see any indicators that predation was a primary factor resulting in a decline in that population. Down in the Blue Mountains, so just a real quick recap, in 2019 we were 25% below objective. We came up a little bit this year where we're only 16% below, so we don't meet the criteria in the Blue Mountains currently, but we do remain concerned down there because of what we're seeing in our calf ratios. We've been seeing a steady decline in calf ratios since 2014. And in this other graph that I threw in there down in the bottom right, we have some GMUs in there where our calf ratios are below 20. And in GMU 186, we were only at 11 calves for every 100 cows this year. So we are concerned there, even though we don't meet the criteria. I put these figures in here, though, to show folks that this isn't necessarily uncharted territory for the Blue Mountains. However, we've been at this kind of level of population abundance before. We've also seen calf-to-cow ratios that were even lower than this in the 90s and in the early 90s. In the early 90s, that prompted directive research to monitor calves and look at that and see what the factors were that were resulting in low calf numbers. And the results from that work was that calf survival was about 50%, 45 to 50% in most years, which is kind of where we expect. Leading cause of mortality was cougar at about 48%. Black bear was 15%. But the findings from that work was that there seemed to be indicators that there were a lot of the mortality that was happening on calves in the summer was compensatory. And if the predation went away, we would probably still have calves die the rest of the year. Predator management actions were not implemented, and that population did come out of that low spot. Part of that was related to them reducing antlerless harvest. We also reduced antler harvest in 2006 as well. And as soon as we kind of do that, we see this respond in the population. But that's also kind of why we're concerned, because we're not seeing that response, even though we've backed off on antlerless harvest significantly in the Blue Mountains. So I know we're running out of time, didn't get to go as much detail. So where we're at there is we are considering, hey, let's start the discussion, you know, in the Blue Mountains. Let's start talking about this. And so we've kind of initiated the first step, where we're defining the problem. We have a first draft of a document that we've put together trying to lay out what we think the rationale is for considering something. And that's a first draft form, hoping to have something more final by the end of summer. And that's the end. So I'll take some more questions in the last few minutes.
Yeah. Thanks. Again, being attentive to time, are there any questions from commissioners?
Can we ask a quick, this is Barbara, could yeah. I ask a quick question?
Yes, Barbara, go ahead.
Okay, this may be what Molly characterizes as one of her questions, but on the mule deer slides, I just don't get why on the Muckleshoot Indian Tribe study, it shows cougars being the cause of almost 40% of the mortalities. And yet then on the next slide where it's by year, the cougars only range between 5 and 10% of the mortalities. What am I missing?
So the first slide is just saying, okay, over the course of this study, we've had 100 mortalities. 40% of those were cougar. What the next slide is actually saying is that on an annual basis, X percentage of deer are dying because of cougar. So a lot of people will take that 40% on the first slide and they'll interpret that to mean that 40% of deer are dying because of cougar every year. And that's, the next slide is just clarifying what's the actual rate.
Okay, thank you for that.
Maybe just add one more thing to as the example. So let's say we could remove all cougar mortality. Doe survival, we would only expect doe survival to go up 5% if the annual cougar mortality is 5%. We took cougar out of the equation, we would only expect adult survival to go up 5%.
Okay. Thanks again.
In public health, we call it prevalence and incidence. So I'm not seeing any other questions, and we do need to move along. I'll put this to the committee. This is probably something that we want to keep on the agenda as we're moving forward with the white-tailed deer plan and the game management plan, just to kind of periodically see what the thinking is, as more of the data is analyzed and that sort of thing. Is that correct, committee?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot, Brock. I will move on now. And we have a presentation on grazing management. This is gonna be before the entire commission for policy and rule update. So it's an important topic. I don't know, Eric, do you want to introduce it into the presentation?
You know, we're so strapped on time, I want to give it all to the team, so I'm going to turn it immediately over to Cynthia and her team, and they can do any intro they want as they launch into it, but thank you.
Thanks, Commissioner. Thanks, Eric. I am going to hand it pretty quickly over to Paul Damer, who's going to give a broad overview about where we are and where we're headed, and then Jeff. I think we had originally had about a half hour presentation. I know he's trying to adapt. And I know that we also needed to have at least a couple of minutes on hot topics. So hopefully we can get the discussion and give it its due. This is an update, the next steps in our grazing program review, follow up from our committee meeting in September. And we have had a few more sort of deep dive in a couple of the specific areas, and you'll be hearing about that. So take it away, Paul.
Thank you, Cynthia. And good morning, everybody. Thanks for your time today. I'll jump right in. As Cynthia said, we're going to reintroduce you to our grazing program review this morning. Jeff Burnham's going to take us through a presentation in just a couple of minutes. We're going to focus on four pieces today. The grazing WAC, proposed changes to that, the commission grazing policy, and then two new tools that we're looking to implement, the grazing evaluation framework for any potential new grazing across the state to look at risks and benefits and costs in a comprehensive, consistent way, and an annual operation plans that we've been developing just recently and look to further develop to manage wolf livestock interactions on our grazing permit. So those four pieces, we will be coming to you in September to the full commission to give a presentation and then ask for specifically a decision in October on potential changes to the WAC and the policy. We have gone out for some public, aside from our extensive internal process, cross-program agency process, we have gone out for some public input on this as well. Back in November, Cynthia pulled together some meetings with conservation groups and producers. We also had two fairly significant webinars with larger groups of conservation groups, producers in May. We reached out to the tribes, we reached out to all of our grazing permittees, as well as our Wildlife Area Advisory Committee members, all of them for input. And we will be doing additional input through the formal CEPA process and the rule review process that will start at the end, around the end of July and run through the middle of August. Some of the comments we've heard so far are in support of our program. There's some disagreement and some concerns in part as to whether grazing is compatible with our mission. The suggestions that folks would like to see public comment and review of all of our grazing permits, whether they're new ones or whether they're renewals that we do each year periodically. And we're looking to have further conversations and understanding that request. There's concern about the economic feasibility of grazing on our lands that have been expressed so far. Some feel strongly that livestock should be removed before any lethal removal of carnivores on our lands. And some feel strongly that the grazing WAC should be clearly, in the grazing WAC, we should clearly state that we will always be consistent with our strategic plan. And we've already made that change for those comments in the presentation that you'll see today from Jeff. We'll be responding to these comments and any other ones we get in working with folks and looking at any potential changes before we come to you in September. But today, again, our focus is on getting these four pieces presentation to you and getting any of your input so that we can prepare better for that September briefing meeting to you. So I'm going to hand it over to Jeff and have him go through the presentation. Jeff's been great pulling our grazing program consistency monitoring program together over the last 6 years he's been with us, and a real great help to us to move forward. So handing it over to Jeff now.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks, members of the committee. Really appreciate being able to be here today and take a few minutes. I think we'll be able to fit things in, but I guess who knows where the discussion goes for sure. Let me get it called up here. I don't think I'll rehash any of Paul's introduction. Currently, there isn't any high-level rationale for the department's grazing beyond a couple of sentences in the existing commission policy. The grazing WAC mostly amounts to direction regarding the mechanics of permit renewals. And as a result of the internal work group that Paul described, since we've been operating on this fairly consistently since about 2017, we have the newly formalized guidance, which constitutes the what, the why, and the requirements for grazing on WDFW lands. And so I want to give just enough context so you can understand where those four pieces that Paul mentioned fit into the overall document. The purpose and vision that you see here establish that WDFW grazing permits will be consistent with the department's mission, law, policy, legal agreements, and will be compatible with fish and wildlife related recreation. They'll also be implemented consistently around the state and maintain ecological integrity. Sorry about that. Moving into the statutory authority section, we lay out the RCWs that permit the department to acquire and manage land and to lease it subject to ecosystem standards. Here also, we provide the proposed full text, including changes of the commission policy and the department's grazing WAC. Our internal work group recommended a section expanding on the roles of grazing and also including a section on managing risk. The section that you see there about the roles of grazing, that's an expansion of the roles that are identified within the commission policy. And that expansion includes literature review and examples of how things are currently happening on the wildlife areas. We're going to spend the next few minutes digging into the policy and the WAC in more detail. And following that, we'll address wolf livestock conflict management. So just a note as we begin, in the following slides, the text is very close to or identical to what appears in the current wording of these directions. But in a few cases, the strike-through text and the underlined text refer to ideas rather than verbatim language. And that's just my attempt to adapt this material to a PowerPoint presentation like this. The policy outlines a set of values, and the first statement emphasizes the primacy of WDFW's mission. None of the identified roles for grazing that you'll see can interfere with that. And we feel that instead of requiring consistency with a strategic plan, this policy should require consistency with the WAC, because as you'll see, the WAC itself already requires consistency with a strategic plan. I mentioned those roles of grazing in the expanded section. Well, they're summarized here. The existing roles for grazing you can see in the struck-through text, we feel that we can condense these into one role, which is to manage vegetation for fish and wildlife, and we think it improves on that word manipulate, which has some negative connotations. We're adding one about enhancing recreational opportunity, and we're giving a little bit more context on the current objective, which the commission policy calls out, of coordinated resource management. The current policy doesn't really do much to explain why that might be a value, though. And so we're trying to state it explicitly here, which is to encourage conservation across multiple ownerships on landscape scales, on large scales. And then the final one of protecting community character was added in response to discussion and recommendation from this committee back in September at the Winthrop meeting. For any grazing permit that we issue, the first two caveats should remain unchanged: to integrate with other uses and to maintain ecological integrity. The change in the third item is suggested because of the difficulty of the word all and the inherent trade-offs involved with any kind of land management decision, even those not concerning livestock. This new language also echoes the grazing evaluation framework, which we'll briefly review later. The next point in the commission policy has to do with cross-program review. This review is already occurring. Yes.
Yeah. Can we break? This is Kim. And hi there. I just want to let everybody know that we've added some time, so you don't need to feel totally under pressure. And want to, since we're it's sort of at a turning point in the PowerPoint, ask if there are any questions or comments from commissioners at this point. I have a question about maintaining ecologic integrity, and perhaps this is going to unfold as you go on, but what always comes up in that sort of goal for grazing management is the monitoring and you know, do we have a baseline of ecologic integrity on the lands where we're grazing, that kind of thing? If you're going to talk about it later, which I don't recall, but, or you can answer now.
Yeah, thanks, Commissioner Thorburn. I was going to talk about it later. I guess I'll leave that up to you if you want to address it right now or in the context of that grazing management tool.
Yeah, let's we'll talk about it in the grazing management till then. Fine.
Okay.
Great. Thanks.
Yeah, I also wanted to mention that I do plan to stop and ask for comments after each one of the four pieces. So keep that in mind, but also feel free to break in and interrupt me.
Great.
Okay, maybe I'll continue for the moment. We feel that because district team review is already occurring, we suggest the time has come to replace the word develop with conduct. District teams vary a little bit in how they talk about grazing permits, but those districts with grazing permits. Note that this requirement does not apply to temporary grazing permits. We've marked these items for removal because in the commission policy, they were either redundant with or sometimes inconsistent with language in the WAC. For example, in the case of grazing management plans, the WAC language is a bit more stringent, so it makes sense to go with the WAC language. Okay, so those are the points of the policy that are changing or being removed. Anything that you want to ask or discuss about our suggestions for the commission policy?
I don't see any hands up.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Thanks. Yeah, for the most part, that is going to look fairly similar to what we discussed back in September. Moving on to the WAC, there will be some new material. The first bullet point here appears at the top of the WAC, and as with the policy, we wanted to reference the department's mission. Note that desired ecological conditions will remain a part of grazing management plans, a required part. Now, Paul alluded to this. Originally, we had proposed removing the reference to the strategic plan owing to uncertainty associated with its ongoing revision right now. But public comments urged us to keep it in there, and we do agree, and so we've changed that back. The other items are set to remain very similar to existing language, except that there may be some value in distinguishing between a permit that does not get renewed and a permit that gets canceled. Cancellation is a pretty emotionally burdened word, and we would prefer to reserve that for situations of noncompliance and to distinguish between permits that get canceled and permits that might not get renewed for some other reason. And I would note that neither of those circumstances are at all common. That's a pretty rare occurrence. And public access would also be maintained. Now, there are several clarifications or changes having to do with commission review, so let's take them one by one. Commission review is required, and we'll talk about three exceptions. The first exception is no change from the current WAC, which is that temporary permits don't require commission review. The second point is not a huge change, but we wanted to formally specify a 10-year period. The way the RAC reads today, it's just not clear how long a recently expired permit might go before new review would be needed. And so we wanted to specify again 10 years because that would make it consistent with the categorical exclusion that currently exists in SEPA for grazing permits that are getting renewed. Also, there is a potential loophole that exists for temporary permits that could, in theory, later get renewed as non-temporary permits. We want to close that and prevent permits from maybe evading commission review by specifying that this exemption only applies to non-temporary permits. And then the third and final exception would allow the department flexibility to issue grazing permits on new acquisitions. This might be to honor agreements that may have been made during negotiations before we're super familiar with the property. I think that usually when we're in the situation of issuing a grazing permit on newly acquired lands, grazing has been occurring for a long time and would be unlikely to reduce ecological integrity during a transition period. Remember that most permits can last up to 5 years. We're proposing to allow a maximum of 3 years to this transition period, recognizing that after that, not only will we understand the property better, but the commission should get a chance to examine grazing on that new acquisition, even if it has been happening for a long time. And then the final point on commission review, this is a change. Currently, the commission essentially has to opt out of a grazing permit once we bring it before them. We're asking the commission to opt in to grazing permits as long as they conform to the policy. We don't envision asking for your signatures or anything like that. Rather, we would seek this approval in the context of a regular commission meeting. Currently, when a permit expires, there are several options in the WAC, but discontinuing a permit is not among them. So in addition to retaining these three options when a permit expires, staff wanted to clearly provide the director with the option of not renewing a permit. And we realized that it would be important to provide sufficient notice and explanation of that kind of action. The next requirement has to do with grazing management plans. And the only change to this requirement would be to allow temporary permits to proceed without management plans when the actual grazing time on WDFW lands is less than a total of 14 days. Now, this one is a little bit hard to describe concisely in print, but what that would do, for example, it would allow a manager to issue a permit for the term of, say, 1 month, as long as the grazing is limited to a certain window within that month. So if we have a 2-day crossing permit, the manager can issue the permit for a period of 3 or 4 weeks, as long as we're stipulating that within that period of 3 or 4 weeks, the actual time on WDFW lands would be limited to the duration of the crossing, 2 or 3 days. So that's the type of situation that we're trying to address there. Okay, let's pause again. There are several topics there in the WAC. Anything that we want to discuss? As a reminder, we had grazing management plans.
Any questions from? So I have a couple of questions, I think. So it appears that we can, that the commissioners can weigh in on discontinuing grazing altogether on a wildlife area if it's a new acquisition where grazing was part of the original agreement and that's sustained for up to 3 years, then the commission weighs in. And we can decline a permit. Is that with a specific contractor operator, or is there a role for the commission to decide that grazing is no longer going to be part of the management of a wildlife area, that we'll discontinue it altogether? Is that envisioned in the WAC?
I might punt to Paul there, but my suspicion is that that conversation might be better set within the context of a wildlife area management plan. Right now, what we envision in the WAC would be limited to permit review, but let me see if Paul has anything to add.
I think the planning process and input into the planning process is a good point where the commission could look at those and weigh in if they chose to. As it stands right now, Commissioner, for the new acquisitions, you're correct. After 3 years, in order to continue grazing on those new acquisitions, they would need to come to you and for your review and approval or not. For existing grazing permits on our lands, the WAC does not have a mechanism for you to specifically look at a grazing permit and not allow it.
Okay, I don't know how other committee members feel, but perhaps I would like staff to take a look at that. It does seem to me something perhaps that the commission might want to weigh into. As Jeff pointed out, rarely do we see a need for altering permits in negative ways, but we do sometimes get public input that might want us to weigh in on something like this.
And we would be any happy other? Also. Yeah, we'd be happy to provide what our process is and the cross-program review and the details on the effort that goes into looking at permits before they're renewed, just to help with that discussion.
Thanks, Paul. Anybody else? Anything else on the WAC? Go ahead, Jeff.
Thank you, Commissioner. We've tried to make the first point in the section on managing risk abundantly clear. We've stated it in one way or another repeatedly. Some of the specific protective measures were reported to the Commission in 2017. In the document, the section includes examples not only of these protections, but examples of where risk has been managed appropriately, including in places like Western riparian areas. The final piece of guidance has to do with wolf-livestock conflict. So here we lay out a priority for wolf conservation, and we refer to measures and plans that we'll describe in a little bit more detail in just a moment. The final point is simply by way of reminder. This document has no guidance or requirements at all for when wolves might or might not be lethally removed, because those decisions are governed by the Wolf Recovery Plan and the Wolf Livestock Interaction Protocol. What this document does is attempt to minimize the likelihood of conflict associated with the WDFW grazing permit. So those are the six sections on guidance. The next portion of the document is called the management tools. We're including five management tools that demonstrate how the guidance is implemented. Three of them are specifically mentioned by policy or WAC, and two of them provide transparency to topics of a special interest. The first group of items mentioned in WAC or policy include these three things. This is the way we've been doing things for a few years, but we do plan to add annual operational plans to the overall grazing plans. As a concept, ecological integrity is broad and holistic. Quantifying ecological integrity is not something I would describe as a fully settled science, but just because a tool isn't perfect doesn't mean that it's without value. So we, along with several other land management agencies, do calculate and track ecological integrity scores. Those ecological integrity scores are based on monitoring data that is closely modeled on several federal protocols. So we're gathering information on relative abundance of plant species and soil condition, and we're comparing that from one time to another. Within the last few years, what we've observed is that any changes to ecological integrity have almost always been small and mostly non-significant. We did get one statistically significant increase on a grazing permit. I think that was on the Quillamine unit. And we saw one statistically significant decrease in ecological integrity, which was on the Blue Mountains. And we're working through that one right now to figure out the most appropriate way to respond. The second group of tools provide topics to provide transparency to topics of particular interest, like I mentioned. And maybe before I go on, Commissioner Thorburn, did that help with your question about monitoring and ecological integrity, or was there something else I could clarify?
No, that's helpful. Thanks.
Okay. We've reported to the commission before about the grazing evaluation framework and we created it because we felt we needed a better process with which to respond to inquiries about grazing on department acreage. A number of our employees regularly field these types of requests, and we just didn't feel like we were responding to them consistently or fairly. What it is a process of identifying objectives and risk for new grazing in the context of those roles that are spelled out in commission policy. It doesn't apply to temporary permits or acreage permitted within the last 10 years. And again, that's to be consistent with language in the WAC and SEPA. It would apply to all other new grazing on WDFW lands. And it would also apply, we envision it implying, on applying to grazing that would begin or possibly continue on lands being considered for acquisition. So our hope is that we could integrate this into the Lands 2020 process. This tool directs who should be involved with the framework and when. And after considering objectives and risks associated with this proposed new grazing, the overall outcome of the framework is a recommendation from field staff to either approve or deny further grazing plan development. The ultimate decision would be the joint responsibility of the Lands Division Manager, the Regional Program Manager, and the Regional Director. Approval, if that's what the decision was, would trigger the regular permit development process. So we'd go through the development of a grazing plan, we'd get review from the district team, and the commission would need to review it as well. We've gone through this process two or three times in about as many years, and we think that it's ready to be formalized. One thing that we did find is that while there are a number of steps on paper, there's not really a reason for this to take a long time. So it's what I'm saying is that it seems to be implementable. Before we move on to the final piece, any questions about the grazing evaluation framework?
I don't see any hands.
Okay, thanks. We've been working on this language for a number of years. Last year, we started adding standardized non-lethal deterrents to all permits getting renewed in Wolf Country. The language varied a little bit from place to place. We feel like we've nailed this down, and so it's ready to go on a wider distribution. This year, we've been settling on the annual operational plan language and direction. We are implementing this on up to four permits, and most of these are in the Blue Mountains. And then next year, we will either renew or amend all grazing permits with potential wolf habitat to provide for the creation of these annual operational plans where wolves occur. So what is an AOP? Yes.
Jeff, it's Cynthia. I just want to clarify, there's been quite a bit of discussion about what is wolf country and where do wolves occur. And we've actually taken the stance that we will just be integrating the standard language into all of our grazing permits statewide. And that the issue of when specific heightened risk factors are triggered, those may bring in additional measures into those specific permits through the annual operating plans. So just some additional clarity there.
Thank you, Cynthia. Yeah, I think at one point there might have been one or two exceptions, but that's not very many compared to the rest of the state. So yeah, fifth statewide, that's great. The AOP process begins at the field level within a given district. And so the wildlife area manager, the wildlife biologist, and the conflict specialist are going to conduct a risk assessment and provide some recommendations. The risk assessment looks at a variety of factors, and it concentrates on those that could be associated with high risk. And so those are, for example, the presence of dinner rendezvous sites near the permit area, depredations actually on the permit area, and also a certain number of depredations within the local pack, regardless of location. The outcome of this discussion is going to be a set of customized non-lethal deterrence measures and possibly a recommendation to temporarily remove livestock or defer turnout. On the recent annual operational plans on the 4-0 Ranch, for example, we identified some fencing measures and we agreed to these with joint responsibility shared between the department and the permittee. So there are two permittees there. And again, annual operational plans do not and will not authorize lethal removal of wolves because that is a separate decision process. For step two, we bring in a few more employees. The intended result of their discussion is that the wildlife area manager will understand the recommendations or requirements and the amount of flexibility, if any, inherent in those recommendations. With this understanding, the wildlife area manager and the permittee are going to have a discussion until they have consensus about the required measures. With the recent AOPs on the 4-0 Ranch, this consensus occurred without a lot of difficulty. There could be situations where consensus is hard. So if we don't have it right away, we move into an iterative process between those staff in step two and the wildlife area manager and the permittee. And as Donnie pointed out in a recent discussion, this characterizes a lot of wolf management as an iterative process where we improve as we go. It does imply a need to communicate pretty carefully because this is back and forth between a lot of busy people. And then the final step in the AOP is step five. Step five would only apply if one of those two events occurred during the grazing season. So the development of a den or rendezvous site near the permit area or any depredation within the local pack. So step five does not mean we're beginning again from square one. What it does mean is that we need another risk assessment and we might end up with additional customized recommendations for that particular site. So are there any questions that we can talk about with regard to the annual operational plan?
I would just offer one other piece is that there was specific concentrated discussion about the issue of temporary removal of livestock in the case in these cases, and that is one of the additional non-lethal measures that is available.
Yes, exactly.
Jeff, this is Molly. If I may, one concern I had on these steps, and I know I've already shared them with you, I'm just repeating them so for the sake of the other commissioners on this, is that this would be a time-sensitive matter for both producers and wolves, really, if and so I was hoping that there would be some language around this being sort of an open end, it sounds like an open-ended loop. I'm not sure that's the intention. And I was hoping that we could put some sideboards on how long, you go through this repeating the steps because, if it takes 2 weeks for these people to all get together, because as you said, they're all very busy people, that could cause problems for wolves and that could cause problems for livestock producers. And so I was just wondering if there'd been any, further discussion on that or if there's anything we can do to kind of tighten that up a little bit.
Yes, thank you for that question, Commissioner. There is language that it's not on the screen, but it is in the document that talks about time. So the finished product, the annual operational plan that is signed and ready to go right now, that is supposed to be finished either a month before turnout each year or in time for the annual CRM meetings if the permit is associated with a CRM. And typically I think that the time for beginning is within 2 months from turnout for step one to start. And what we were trying to do is balance the need to give as much notice as possible to the permittee about any new requirements, and also to have as much of the most recent knowledge about wolf pack behavior in the area that we could get. And then, so that talks about steps 1 through 4. For step 5, we did discuss this with you a little bit previously, but we were not fully comfortable with putting a concrete timeline on step 5. Instead, we have a statement that commits the department to responding as expeditiously as possible, because we know that that would be really critical during the middle of the grazing season.
Any other questions or comments from the commissioners? Okay, Jeff, proceed.
Okay, we're about done. This slide I just threw up so you could see where we are in this process. We've been doing a lot of external outreach that Paul described over the last 3 or 4 weeks. There also was some external involvement that that Cynthia helped organize late last year when we were trying to draft what the AOPs would look like. I would also note that we have met with Joe Shoren at the Attorney General's office. We've incorporated his suggestions. And then just to conclude, the 4 pieces that we would expect to brief the full commission on are these. So the commission policy, the grazing WAC, the grazing evaluation framework, which is new grazing, and the wolf livestock conflict language. And so I guess one of the things that we're asking you today is confirmation that this is the appropriate approach.
Any comments or questions? I certainly think this is the appropriate approach. There are issues we need to be involved in, and appreciate that you've kept us apprised as this sort of hot topic has moved along. Appreciate your work. So, anybody else? Questions, comments?
Barbara?
Yeah, Barbara.
I agree. I think this is absolutely the correct approach. I have one just contextual question that it's simply, out of our about 1 million acres of managed public land, how much of it is subject to grazing like now?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I actually looked that up 2 or 3 weeks ago. I don't remember the exact acre figure. I want to say it's on the order of about 120,000 acres, but the percentage was something like 11.5% of the wildlife areas currently have some sort of grazing permit.
Thanks. And then, so as a backstop of this, and again, I think this is terrific work. And I especially like the fact that the decisions need to be made quickly. As a backstop, it'd be interesting to me, and I might maybe call separately, to figure out where the overlap is between our grazing permits and wolf habitat. So that's just another curiosity of mine, but thanks.
We do have that mapped, Commissioner, and I'm happy to share that. With anyone, but yeah, we mapped that as part of the work over the past year.
Thank you.
This is Jim Anderson. I have a question with regard to external outreach, and you mentioned it a little bit, but could you expand on what has been done since late April over the past, 6 weeks, 7 weeks?
Paul, did you maybe want to review that?
Sure. So just in the last, in that time period, Commissioner, we have had 2 webinars with producers, cattlemen's association, with conservation organizations, probably together organization-wise, we're talking about maybe 40 different organizations, and we have reached out, and then we took comments at these webinars. We also created a website, or I'm sorry, an email address, and took comments to our email address as well in writing, provided the documents for review. We reached out to the tribes, haven't heard anything back yet, but they also will be continue to be on our recall list. We made specific contact with all of our permittees for their input, and our Wildlife Area Advisory Committee members we reached out to and for an opportunity to give input. And then I'll just go on to mention that we will be doing the formal public comment period through CEPA and the rule review.
Okay. Thank you. That's helpful.
Anybody else?
Well, I would just note that there are several of the people that have participated in those external discussions that are actually present on at this meeting. So that's good to see.
Thanks, Cynthia. So it looks like we're good with that topic. Look forward to the next steps. Cynthia, you had some other hot topic issues that you wanted to bring up. We've got about 20 minutes left.
Yeah, I just had one. I don't know if Eric, if you had others, but we definitely did want to give you a heads up and an update on where we are with the target shooting rule, because we just closed the CEPA public comment yesterday, and there's quite a volume there, and that's probably leading to us adapting a little bit in our approach in the conversation with the commission. So I'm going to let Joel Sisolak, who's on the line, give more details into that. He's leading up managing that effort.
Thanks, Cynthia. Good afternoon, everyone. Yeah, I just wanted to quick give you a heads up in preparation for the presentation and hearing tomorrow afternoon. I think we're at the tail end of the day. We have had a lot of interest in this topic, which is not super surprising, but I don't think we quite anticipated the volume of comment. We've received well over 1,300 comments on the proposed rule. And just as a quick recap, the goals for the rule are to continue to provide opportunities for target shooting while also protecting public safety as well as habitat and property. The public comment just closed yesterday. And what we've heard is just like a slim majority of the people commenting were commenting in opposition to adopting the rule. And that's pretty, that's somewhat split between folks who don't feel we should be restricting, or that the rule is too restrictive, or we shouldn't be restricting target shooting so much, and folks who feel like it's not restrictive enough. So we're still parsing all of the comments, and that's going to take a little bit of time. So we will we'll be asking the commission to extend the process a little bit. We'd like to return in July to give a more full accounting of public comment, and also provide some recommendations in terms of revisions to the proposed rule update. And then have a vote, we hope, in September. We had already planned to push the enactment of the proposed rule to January to provide more time for public education about the rule, educating both shooters as well as produce some more educational materials about where it's safe and okay to go shoot. So a little bit of an adjustment to the timeline from what we had anticipated previously, but we feel still is kind of keeping on track when we wanted to enact it, and will provide a better accounting and integration of public comment.
I would just add one piece of content. I don't think I heard you say that at last count I was aware of over 1,300 comments. So as I said, it's quite a volume, and there's a lot of nuance to parse, as Joel has said, and we want to take the time to do that right.
And I'm pretty happy that Sorry, go ahead.
No, Joel, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to note, you know, that this has been a long process, and it started with the WENAS Target Shooting Advisory Committee, and I'm happy to let you know that we have a few of those folks who will be on the meeting tomorrow to provide their perspective as well.
Commissioners, any questions or comments? The presentation tomorrow talks about plans, well, where we have structured target ranges and plans for additional ones. I think it will be, it certainly will be of interest to me to see public response to that.
Yeah, this thanks.
Jim?
Yeah. Well, yeah, okay, thank you. Well, I'm looking forward to the presentation tomorrow. I think the idea of taking more time if needed is wise. I think the idea of rushing something like this, it isn't life-threatening, I hope, you know, that it's something that we take the time, do it right, and get to a decision. So I, you know, I think you're wise to pay attention to the comments and go from there. So
I do want to make a quick note, and to your comment, Commissioner Thorburn, that the presentation that you'll see tomorrow afternoon, the slides have been updated, and you may not we won't be, because we wanted to spend a little bit more time getting into the specifics of the rule, and because we know, or at least we're hoping we would be back in July, we're going to spend a little less time on where sites are being developed or considered for developing, but that would definitely be kind of in the next phase. So we decided to retool the presentation a little bit to focus more on what the rule actually says.
Okay, thanks, Joel, for that heads up. Anybody else on this topic? Eric, Anis, anybody else with hot topics? Dave, I see you on.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would only add another topic that I know is of great interest to this committee is the cougar safety work. And just wanted to let folks know that that continues to move ahead. I've been working on placing the type of work that I believe we can engage in and our game plan for that into some project management software and the ability to kind of map out who's responsible for what and what kind of roles we will play. And our team is formally coming together to really put more meat on all of that skeleton next week. And so I just want to let you know that we're still moving forward with that work and it's making some progress and you'll be hearing more about it soon.
Topics, and we want to give them the time that is needed and due. Appreciate everyone for listening in, and at this point, I think we'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting. Thanks, everybody, for your participation.
Thank you.
Thank you.